Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're at Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Ella Mapes and James Boddington, two young people from Bristol, discuss the mobile phone, liberation or curse. They talk about their use of social media and whether or not they're able to actually put their mobile phone down sometimes. Also, Andreas Roxson, he's the producer of an award-winning documentary from Sweden about the assassination of the UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld back in 1961. The film is called Cold Case Hammarskjöld. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. If you've got someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show. Well, I'm joined by Ella Mapes and James Boddington here in the studio, two very young compared to me. I'm in my mid-50s. James, how old are you?
24 years old.
And Ella?
I'm 20.
Okay, so much, much younger than me, really, and a generation, or even maybe even two generations, no, probably a generation below me. Now, I think what would be interesting and useful to talk about is this whole real, you could almost call it an obsession, and I get moaned about for this, is being on Twitter and being on social media all the time. I think we'll start with you, Ella. What is your relationship like with your phone? Because, you know, I see young people today, they seem to be almost always on their phones, walking down the street on the phone, on the bus, even, say, you know, with some friends in a pub. On the phone. So how often do you use your phone?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's a pretty accurate representation of most people my age. I pretty much am married to my phone, as bad as it sounds to say. I use my phone for pretty much everything. I take it with me everywhere.
Does it make a difference what type of phone you have? I mean, we hear all about things like trainers and stuff like that. You've got to have the right kind of trainer. Do you have to have a particular type of phone? Is there pressure to do that?
I think that pressure, I probably not so much nowadays. I mean, Apple is still the kind of main key kind of fashion.
Oh, you've got to have an iPhone.
You've got to have an iPhone.
I heard a joke once, says, but how do you know if someone's got an iPhone? They tell you. But anyway, so it doesn't really matter what type of phone, but you take it everywhere.
Pretty
is there
much.
Anywhere you really do feel like you have to put it? I mean, say, for example, going swimming or something.
I mean, the beach, but that's a painful one, and I'll normally find a way around it. I think most people are pretty resilient finding places to take their phones.
Okay, well, I'll ask you why you seem to be so attached to your phone in a minute, but what about you, James? Are you taking your phone everywhere with you?
I mean, I see it as an incredible multi-tool, you know, like, and I think, it's so useful. I can use it for notes. I can take photos with it, I can listen to podcasts, I can read books. So I resent the idea that it being a negative thing that everyone's always on their phone all the times, because I think you'd have a different reaction if you saw them holding a newspaper or a notepad.
See, when you talk about books, I'm thinking about something physical with pages, but for you, that's something that you carry around on your phone.
Yeah, I think, definitely with like audible sort of books.
Okay, so you're listening to audio
Kindle
books,
Kindle
not written
well.
Books necessarily.
I could be, and I do.
I mean, I'm a bit naughty, really. I quite often scribble in books. So if I see something, I'll scribble something in the margin. How do you do that if you're just listening to it?
You can. Oh, well.
There's multiple.
Then, I mean,
multiple
you could just open notes and then write. There's ways around that.
Yeah.
And with. Also, with Audible, you can make notes and bookmarks, and probably with more sort of fluidity that you get than
so
you can
you
with
see,
a book.
So you see it as a real asset, having a phone.
I think that, like with everything, we should inspect and scrutinise our personal relationship with it rather than sort of demonising what I believe it to be, which is an incredible multi-tool.
Now, some people talk about having a relationship with their car, don't they? They give it a name. You know, as they get in, they say, "Hi, Elsa or whatever it happens, happens to call it. And they do that as a kind of joke, almost like a pet, you know, talking to a pet. So you're talking about almost a similar type of relationship, James, with a phone, that you're talking about it as a kind of a friend almost.
I just more see the potential and feel fortunate that it's accessible to me in this day and age and accessible to most people.
How do you feel when you have to put it aside, say, as I mentioned just now, with going swimming or something?
I mean, I love swimming because of that, because of the simplicity of it and because of that I don't have my phone. And so it kind of forces you to, I mean, you can daydream, but it like forces you to be a little bit more mindful and a little bit like you're just chilling out and you're not sort of,
Are you ever swimming down the lanes thinking, oh God, get back on my phone?
Me personally, no, but like I can't speak for everyone else.
Okay, what about you, Ella?
Well, the thing about the phone is I feel like, especially with the older generation, it has such a negative image, but it doesn't. I mean, when I say I want to have my phone on me all the time, it's not because I want to make sure that I'm checking the latest messages or scrolling through Instagram. It's more kind of like a secure tool, like you said, James. And even when you go places, like you're talking about prohibited places with phones, there's nowadays like trends for pubs to be like no phone kind of area, we want you to talk. But just because you have a phone, it doesn't mean you're not socializing with the person you're with. It's more just you have that, it's kind of like a safety net almost, and you can do so many things. Google Maps is I don't know how people survived without Google Maps. It is brilliant.
Well, we used to just remember where the roads were.
Well, in a place you don't know.
Yeah, let's ditch maps altogether because we should just remember.
Yeah, I have seen that on TV once, so I know exactly where I'm going. But I went travelling last year. I'd be in Thailand, not have a clue where anything is. Google Maps, done. It was my safety line. And also, with my parents, it was a godsend to them because my mum could always check my like Snap location on Snapchat. We could FaceTime each other. It was brilliant. It is just a really good way to connect with people as well.
So is there any feeling that you get that maybe you're too dependent on the phone?
I think I get that feeling when I've just been like doing nothing and I check my phone, because I don't even know why I do it. I think I generally think it's just a social connection thing, because you can, if you're talking with people, it's not like you're just doing nothing. You're having a connection with someone, and whether or not it's virtual, it's still a connection.
Yeah. Well, are you both on Facebook?
Yeah, but I have
kind of, not really. It's
intermittent.
Yeah, it's kind of the things with social media. They trend, don't they? Mm. So Facebook used to be a huge thing, but now it's kind of switched.
So what's the real place to be now then?
I don't know, like...
Well, for me anyway, I don't use Facebook in the same way. I use it for events and Messenger because I got all my friends on there. I don't use it in the way that it's designed to be used.
So you're not taking a selfie, putting it onto Facebook and saying, hi everyone, look, I'm on Clifton Suspension Bridge or something?
For me, that kind of stuff has shifted to Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, but it's definitely... like shifted.
And it's funny because you can see kind of the age gap as well.
Yeah,
there's a joke that's some kind of something like a mum would do.
Yeah,
it's like a really mum thing.
That's a good point.
And whereas if your mum doesn't Instagram, you're like, oh, she knows what's going on.
But with Facebook, it's just an example. It's just one form of social media, which I know quite a lot, reasonable amount about. I mean, you've got the owner of it, Mark Zuckerberg, this week over at the Munich Security Conference, talking to all the kind of military of the world. He's almost in another planet. Obviously, you know, when you're connecting up to these various sorts of social media, even if it's just searching using Google, it's connecting up to you too. So do you ever wonder, well, these people have got my life. Mm. They actually know sometimes more about me than I know about myself.
Yeah, I mean, it is sometimes scary. You'd be like, I mean, me and my friends say sometimes we'll be talking on the phone about something or we'll be chatting face to face, completely unrelated subject, and then that will come up on, it's like an ad on like Facebook, or it will come up on Instagram. Or you've Googled something and then a year later you'll still be kind of getting adverts related to that thing you Googled. And that is kind of scary. However, I think the sheer amount of people who use social media and the sheer amount of data it must have on everyone it's too big to scare me, if that makes sense. I think if something terrible did happen, I don't think it would happen
What do you mean by terrible?
So something to do with identity theft or, you know, there's kind of fears about you having your identity stolen, or, you know, you don't know kind of what's happening with that information.
But the thing is that they're creating a massive profile on you, aren't they? So they will have a whole kind of bunch of categories, and, you know, Ella is into this, she likes this, she's been searching for this for the last few years, she's trending towards that. And that is all a commodity that they can then sell to a potential advertiser.
It is. But the thing about the internet is it is virtually impossible nowadays to delete yourself off the internet, even if you've been on it once or twice. Once you've made an account somewhere, it might even be a tiny little website, you're on the internet.
So it sounds like the Hotel California that you can't leave. You know, you can check out, but you can never leave.
Yeah,
James, what about you and your use of social media? Do you ever worry about the idea that you're connecting up to the internet, but the internet is also connecting right up to you? Say, for example, if someone was to say to you, well, where were you, two or three months ago on a Wednesday, you wouldn't be able to remember, but the internet would, or Facebook, whatever, whoever you've been using, Instagram would.
I don't worry about it enough to like go to the extent of trying to cover my tracks and disengage. Like I think that to really like kind of safeguard yourself on that, I think you have to get savvy, and
I feel like a bit of a Luddite here. You know, like I don't want to use this technology, but you guys are absolutely embracing it. But I mean, there is a serious side to it. And that is things like, for example, medical companies might be interested in, you've talked about having some medical condition, they've got a little link to that, and then suddenly you try and get health insurance or travel insurance or something, and they say, no, you're not having it.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
It's never ending with the data being sold and stuff. It's mad. And I think why most people don't care about it is probably because it's not, like that, firstly, it's like new concepts, like the internet is a new concept, and so it's quite hard to get your head around. And also because it's not, you know, it's not an immediate danger, and like everyone's doing it, and everyone can just crack on, use the internet, and it's not like, yeah, it's not right at the forefront of your experience.
So, talk about me for a minute. Do you think people like me are Luddites? I mean, a Luddite is okay, we're going back a long time before I was born, actually, but the Luddites were back in the agricultural revolution, and they would do things like burn agricultural machinery because it was taking their jobs away, and so they didn't like the technology. And I would argue that the Luddites were right, really, to do that, because it was really a question of who owned the technology. So someone would come along, buy one of these great threshing machines or whatever, and then put all these workers out of a job. And it was whoever it was, the mill owner or whoever that owned this thing, if they could have all bought it together, collectively or whatever, they could have sat there in the sun and enjoyed watching this machine working and kept their incomes. But they didn't, you know.
But the thing about, that's kind of the issue between technology and just social development. So back to kind of the issue about, well, our mobile phones stealing our identity and they're invading our privacy. That's not a mobile phone issue. That's just a privacy issue altogether. They're talking about facial recognition in security cameras and what that can do for, you know, stopping crime. And so it's kind of a wider issue than just, are you on your mobile phone too much? It's more just that technology develops and that's an inevitable change, and it's more about preparing yourself for that change, working with that change instead of going against it.
Ella, do you ever get to saying, well, I'm just going to put my phone aside for a day or a couple of days, or does that ever happen?
I mean, I have tried. The main reason why I would do that is because of my education. You know, revising for exams and stuff, it is really, really not good to have your phone on, because anything to help you procrastinate from an exam, from revising an exam, is...
So you have to actually switch it off, do you?
Yeah.
Put it out of arm's length.
Yeah, I've given it to my dad and be like, don't let me touch it until the end of the day.
And do you get a bit funny when it's not...
Not really.
No,
I just get bored. It's just a boredom thing, honestly.
Young people don't really watch television much.
No, I don't even have a TV. I've never had one.
So, but you watch like on demand stuff,
I'll
right?
I watch Netflix.
Like Netflix.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's a complete new generation. I mean, I'm not complaining because much of what's on television. Well, let me ask you, why don't you watch television? Why are you not?
My parents have always been against having a TV anyway. I think it's... And when I tell people now, they're kind of shocked. But then I go to a friend's house and I see what's on TV and I'm kind of just like, why would I want to watch that anyway?
Okay. James, what about you and television? Do you have a good relationship or none at all?
So I'm in my life...
This is old-fashioned media, yeah?
Yeah. Oh, no, I don't touch TV, yeah. No, just because like when you're familiar and feel comfortable on the internet with like finding the movies you want to watch and watching things on Netflix, like... sitting through adverts and you know, being told when you have to watch something is just like, why would you do that? And like, and yet, yeah, I wouldn't. No.
Are you on social media when you're going out in the evening with your friends?
What do you mean?
Are you actually on your phone? Or do you you stick it in your pocket? Or, you know, are you on the phone whilst you're out and about?
I mean, if I'm texting someone, I'll text someone. Like, not so much, really. I only really use Instagram, but... Not really. I try to like focus on the person in front of me.
Okay, good. All right, like you are now. Thank you. Okay, and also like because I quite often see, particularly young people, even you know couples or two or three people, they're sitting around. They're all on their phones sometimes.
That is quite a sad thing when that happens. But honestly, sometimes you just do end up going on your phone having a quick chat with someone. It's not. If I was with someone and then he started having a conversation with someone who I didn't know next to me, I wouldn't be like, wow, that is so rude. It's just, as long as you're not... I just think it's just a normal human
interaction. Yeah, I mean, personally, like, if I'm talking to my brother and we're having a conversation and then he looks down at his phone, I personally get really put off. Like, I'm just like, I'm talking to you, man. Like, I'm just going to stop talking. So, yeah. Like, I'm...
So is there, is there a sort of new etiquette, you think, growing up around this?
There is definitely, like, an unspoken etiquette, probably.
I just feel like someone's not listening to me if they're looking at their phone. That's me. Maybe that's an insecurity, but, like, I just want to have a conversation.
Does it ever feel like an addiction?
For me, it's not an addiction. It's more like... They're very
All addicts say that, don't they?
No, well, they're just really well ingrained habits. Like, you know, I'll go when I cut out Facebook for a bit, I'd notice, like, for a few days, every time I went on the internet, I'd automatically start typing Facebook. I'm not even, like, intending to go on there. So it's very well ingrained for sure. And I feel like when I'm tired, I'm more likely to go on Instagram. When I'm, like, just feeling low, then I'm just looking for distractions. So I can only speak for myself and... I try to pay attention to like my personal relationship with things. Like,
Ella, what about you? An addiction or not?
I wouldn't say an addiction, but I would definitely say I wouldn't live without one. Maybe not live, but I wouldn't. If mine broke tomorrow, I'd have to get.
If you found yourself on a desert island with no mobile phone, would you just scream?
It's not that bad. It's not that bad. It's just more. They are so practical to have.
This is it, isn't it? What is it? What is it you really get out of it?
I mean, it's my way to be in contact with people. It's my way to navigate my way around everything. It's my way to access the news. I read The Guardian on it. It was a great way to take notes of stuff when I was in college. And it has kind of, it is really convenient. We'd be at home. My grandparents, for example, spoke of this guy they once knew who was in the paper because he found a severed hand. They didn't know what his name was, only his like first name, but they knew the date and they knew where it was. And I was able to Google it in like 2 minutes, find them the original newspaper copy and show them. And that was a really cool thing to do, which you wouldn't be able to do without the internet.
A severed hand. That's the benefit.
That is the benefit.
So what about just giving it up? You couldn't really do that. You wouldn't see a point in it.
There's no point.
But you would be like, you'd have to stop participating in a certain part of like contemporary life. Like, I mean, it'd be fine. I mean, you'd probably be fine. It's just like you would be out of the loop in a certain way, and you have to be aware of that.
So, James, can you sum up what you've gotten out of it? Having almost this sort of 24/7. Well, obviously not while you're asleep, I hope. Connection to being online.
No, I can't. It's such a big topic. Like, yeah, I can't really.
But I mean, so what is it, do you think, that the older generations, the pensioners of now, they haven't never had that, have they? What have you got that they haven't?
Well, I feel comfortable on the internet. I feel literate on the internet. Like, and it's a library. It's an archive.
So we don't need need physical libraries anymore?
No, but I mean, like, why?
There's a lot of people saying that, actually, that we just simply do not need a physical library.
That's a whole other.
Whole other conversation.
What do you think? Do you think we need libraries if you've got all this information on the internet?
I think we need public spaces that people feel comfortable in. And if there's books there, then that's great. Like, I think that a library is more than just a place to put books and for people to read.
I mean, have you ever felt abused, bullied on online?
I've had arguments online, which have been fun. but I fortunately have not been the victim of cyberbullying. I think I missed that. I think I'm 24, and I think I wasn't out. I didn't experience that, but I've heard about that.
Yeah, I mean, I know to begin with, you see, if anything does happen, you can just simply block somebody on most of these social media platforms. You can just go, bang, I'm not talking to you again. What about you, Ella?
What, have I ever experienced bullying or?
Yeah, have you ever found, oh gosh, this is actually, I'm having a really bad time here. Who is this and whatever?
There is definitely, I'd say there's definitely a downside to it. I mean, I've never experienced cyberbullying, so I can't speak from that. But James, you're talking about having arguments. The thing about social media is you can write a sentence and it can be taken anyway. It can be taken in a response to something else. It can be kind of manipulated. And also, you've got to remember, once you say something, it's probably going to be out there forever. So you could write a really stupid thing when you were 10 or 11, and then that could get brought up again 10 years' time, and then someone's like, well, why have you said this? And it's happened to a lot of celebrities, actually, a lot of high-flying people. I mean, some people have even lost their jobs, lost their, like, career opportunity because they wrote something when they were younger, really stupid, didn't understand kind of the dangers of social media.
Or sometimes people betray themselves, actually, online, but betray some nasty thing,
but then some
trait
people,
in their character,
some
saying things like,
thrive of it.
Well, we've just had a 10 Downing Street, someone sacked for saying, well, of course, black people are less intelligent than white people, and effectively talking about eugenics, you know, someone in the centre of government, you know. So that sort of thing is quite useful. True. To be able to trace that back to something someone said.
True, but then I guess that's entirely depends on the power. I mean, I could go into the whole what Boris Johnson used to write and used to say, which everyone remembers, but that didn't really
have an effect.
That didn't really have an effect, did it?
Okay, so traditional media, newspapers, you're saying you read The Guardian. What do you make of the today's modern media? Is it doing its job as it should be?
I mean, the media as a whole?
Well, the mass media. We're talking about big newspapers, media, big broadcasters, national stuff.
I think we're quite lucky in England as opposed to somewhere like America, where all their news is very biased. And I would say the BBC is probably a very good objective source. However, there have been reports, especially since the general election, the most recent one, that it is not so, but that it is more biased than people might think. But I would say it's a difficult one because it kind of depends on what your political views are, and the media will always try and go to where there is a target audience. So that's how it just kind of splits naturally.
What do you think, James? The mass media doing their job in this country?
I don't know.
You see, you don't know what you don't know because they're not telling you. Anyway, look, Ella Mapes and James Boddington, lovely to chat to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Cool. Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Andreas Roxén. I'm, since 30 years or so, a journalist, investigative journalist. I've been working with all kinds of TV magazines, Panorama-like, in Sweden. I have also done a few TV series that has been on international broadcast tours. So,
can you just give us an idea of the sort of subjects that you've been covering in these investigations?
Well, I made one series in that must be almost 20 years ago that was about the European refugee policies, where the Frontex system and all of that was described. The series was called Fortress Europe. I made one series or was producing several parts of a series that dealt with international professional football, where we investigated into that, where we managed to show some of the bribing and corrupt culture of the FIFA, where we also had one of the episodes was about the use of medication in sports, in football, and
I mean, here in the UK, most people say, well, investigative journalism is almost dead here. There's not much of it, really. How have you found things in Sweden? Are the big networks, are they actually up for doing some of these tough investigations?
Well, much of what I do, I do for the Swedish National Public Service TV. Also, the private side do have a magazine on that is investigated, and I think it's got a pretty high standard, and it is still alive, though we are always struggling. That has actually been the same since I began 30 years ago.
So how did you come to work on the Dag Hammarskjöld film?
That was Mads, the director, who read an article in The Guardian where Göran Björkdahl, one of the other characters in the film, was presenting his findings, where he had managed to find several new witnesses who saw the crash and were very close to the crash site.
Okay, so maybe we better explain for the listeners. This is about the crash of an aircraft which the Secretary General of the United Nations was travelling on. It was in the 1960s, and this happened in 1961. It was rather different to now, whereas the Secretary General tends to be almost a figurehead in the UN. Back in 1961, Swedish Secretary General of the United Nations, Dag Hammarskjöld, was very much a frontline man. He would go out actually to the various war zones and try and broker peace deals. So that was a very different world. But can you just take us back to the days of the crash and explain who Hammarskjöld was?
Hammarskjöld was elected Secretary General to the United Nations in 1953. And at that time, as you say, the United Nations played a really significant role in world politics. You could almost not open a newspaper at the time without having, you know, quotes or interviews with Dag Hammarskjöld or other UN personnel, you know, when it comes to all kinds of conflicts. And it was a very conflicted time. This is the time of the Berlin Wall. This is the time of the Bay of the Pigs. This is the time of, he was in the Korea War meddling, and he was also in the Suez Crisis, bringing that to an end. So a lot of things were happening, and there was the UN had a very strong voice in what was happening.
So can you explain what Dag Hammarskjöld was doing in Africa, and you know, what the circumstances around the plane crash?
Yeah, were the times of independence, winds of change, as you may know it, where many of the former colonies, both in Africa but also in Asia and elsewhere, they got independence. They sort of turned into the countries of their own. And that happened in the Congo in 1960, when the Belgians, who were the colonizer, they let the Congo become independent. And that caused a lot of turmoil. Only days after that happened, the country went into pieces with several regions declaring self-independence, or they seceded from the nation. And that caused a very deep crisis because, of course, the central government could not allow that because, you know, it was all going into pieces. So that caused the Congo government to ask the United Nations for help. And the United Nations were quite soon, they entered with troops and was trying to stabilize what happened. But what they could not do was to quell the seceding regions. And one of those regions were Katanga, or was Katanga. And that kept on for about a year. It was a very deep conflict where lots of interests were involved. But the Katanga was the rich part of the Congo. That's where most of the mines and the assets of the Congo were. So that was a really big and important conflict. And of course, very soon, it was also in the bull's eye of the Cold War, where the Soviets were there and the Americans were there trying to stabilize the nation, the Congo nation, into their interest. So it was a really difficult and complicated conflict that Dag Hammarskjöld was trying to manage.
And he flew in an aircraft, but he never actually managed it, did he? What happened?
He was in September 1961. He was trying to meet with the president of the seceded region, Katanga, and a meeting was set up in Ndola on the Rhodesian side of the border. So Dag Hammarskjöld was flying to Ndola from the capital of the Congo, Leopoldville, it was called that time. Today it's Kinshasa. He was flying from Leopoldville to Ndola. And just when they arrived to Ndola, they were flying in towards the airport, the plane fell down and crashed, and all 16 on the board died. One person survived for 6 days, and during that time he was talking about the crash and explosions in the air, and that dog had screamed, "Turn back and turn back." So there were already then there were some evidence or some suggestions that there had been some kind of violence around the plane crash.
I mean, in the documentary, you uncover quite a fascinating tale behind this. I think you prove pretty conclusively that the plane was deliberately brought down, that effectively the Director General of the United Nations, it wasn't an accident, he'd been assassinated by some organisation called SAMIR, or I'm not sure how you pronounce it, SAIMR, the South African Institute for Maritime Research. How did you discover these people and who were they?
The South African Institute for Maritime Research, they emerged the first time in 1998 when Desmond Tutu was chairing the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa.
I mean, so what you're saying is they were secret for almost 40 years, and it was nearly the turn of the century before anything was revealed about this organisation.
Yeah, well, no one had heard about them before. So it came as a really big surprise for everyone when he had held a press conference, when he presented 8 documents that was basically communications and letters where you could read the plan and performance by this organization to shoot down Dag Hammarskjöld's plane. He presented those papers and said that we cannot continue investigate this because this was outside the South African, outside our mandate to investigate stuff that is outside of the South African Republic. So they presented the papers and it was reported, and then not much more happened. It was denied by people implied or organizations implied in the documents as the MI6 and the CIA as something set up by the Russians, or it was dismissed, and then not much more happened to it. Then in 2011 a book was published by a British historian whose name is Susan Williams, where she had made some further research into this organization, which pointed in the direction that the organization was actually a true body. There were evidence that it had existed.
One of the fascinating things here is that you've got certain people saying, well, this was just on paper, it wasn't an organisation that really ever existed. And the idea was that the documents were produced just to mislead people.
Yeah, it was. That was an idea or a hypothesis presented by governments implied by the documents, that this was disinformation documents to be used as disinformation and probably set up by the Soviets back in before 1990.
Now, one of the most disturbing things about the documentary is that this SAMIR, the South African Institute for Maritime Research, had an extreme right edge to it. In other words, it was a white racist organization. Of course, the AWB and P.W. Berta, who were the president before the black majority rule in South Africa, it was, of course, quite in line with them. But can you tell us something about how you discovered that this wasn't just any old mercenary or clandestine outfit, that it had this extreme right white supremacist side to it?
Yeah, there are many questions there, but one is that we found a full set of documents emerging from this organization that was handed over to a South African journalist in 1990. So when we went through these documents, we found lists of names of people who had been part of the organization or had been trying to be part of the organization. So we began to call all these people, and eventually, I mean, no one would like to talk to us, or either they didn't like to talk to us or they denied any knowledge about the organization as such. But eventually we found people who not only said that they had been members, but also showed us evidence that they had been part of it. And they told us different stories on what they had done, but at least two members, we found that they had been active in attempts to promote whites towards blacks in a violent way.
What about the headquarters? Because one of them actually took you to the place which had been their military headquarters, which is now in a derelict state. I mean, that must have been some pretty hard evidence there to see something concrete on the ground, which is where they were operating from, Samir.
Yeah, that is a place that is basically a naval base in Johannesburg, which may be contradictory because Johannesburg is very much an inland town. But it's a naval base, and it's run by independent military organization called the SAS RAND, which is also integrated into the South African Defense Forces. There are several of these SASs all over South Africa. So they had this this facility outside Johannesburg, and according to documents and according to the people we talked to, this was the place where they had training there. They also had parades there, and they also had parties and gatherings at that place, which means that they had access to a military facility. Which I also think is the strongest link we have to the South African government or the South African Defense Forces, because it's very hard to tell on whose behalf these people or this organization was acting.
So on the base, were they within a South African military base? In other words, they were under the protection of the South African military?
I would say so. I think that is a strong evidence, though that's the only evidence that we have, that they had access to this place. And we have not been able to corroborate further. There is no admittance from the South African authorities that they have had anything to do with the Symer at all.
Okay, well, one of the most disturbing aspects of your documentary was the evidence that some of the people involved in Symer, or how do you pronounce it?
Symer,
S-A-I-M-R. It's a funny word, but anyway, yeah. Symer. Some of the people involved in it were actually also injecting black Africans with a vaccine. They called it a vaccine, but actually they were injecting them with the AIDS virus. Now, this is an incredible allegation. Was it told you that? And do you think there's any truth to that?
Well, first, the leader of the organization, his name was Keith Maxwell Annandale, and he was leaving a lot of documents behind. And some of these documents dealt with AIDS as a biological weapon, and in the context of killing off blacks to change the power, you know, power structure or the demographic structures in a way that would favor whites in South Africa. So that was only in writing. Then while we were researching, we also found out that this Maxwell, he was acting as a doctor, though he was not a doctor, and he was running clinics and laboratories in South Africa or Johannesburg suburbs. And we also talked to people who told that he was giving false injections at these clinics. And he was offering medical care at a very low cost. So, of course, that is very disturbing to have.
So was he actually, was he a medical doctor? Was he a medical doctor?
No, he was not. He did not have medical education whatsoever. That was, of course, very disturbing to have a person with that kind of mindset and knowing that he was, you know, injecting people. So that was the first. And then we were trying to talk to people, the people that admitted that they had been part of the organization. We tried these documents and to see, you know, what was this all about. And then we found a former member. He was the head of intelligence in Symer, who told us that, yes, they were injecting people and in order to spread the HIV virus. We found a woman was killed in 1990 that was also a member of the organization, and she was working in the laboratories for Symer. And she also, before she died, she told her family that the organization was smuggling contaminated viruses over the borders to Mozambique and Angola. And that was disturbing to her. And then she said that she feared for her life, and only a few weeks after she was killed, she had her throat cut off. So those were all sort of the information that pointed towards that this, at least they had the intention, that was very clear. And from these two persons, we got also the impression that it was not only intention, but that they set that in practice.
Now, one of the key questions that people listening will want to know is, were Saimar backed by the CIA, backed by MI6, the Western Intelligence Services, or was it just a kind of rogue, racist South African organization, a kind of private army with no links to other countries in the West?
According to Alexander Jones, who he participated in several operations, and according to him, there were financiers behind, and those were not South African. So before every operation, they had a briefing. And in these briefings, there was always a chair in the room for the financier. He never knew who they were, but he could tell from the dialect or the pronunciation that they were either French or British. So that points towards France and the UK. Then Susan Williams, the historian, she also has tried to, you know, figure out whether there may be a connection. And her, I would say conclusion is that this is a British outfit, that it was run, it was a military clandestine organization in the hands of British financial interests, sort of a private army for Brits with financial interests in Southern Africa.
Now that suggests maybe, you know, mining firms, big companies like that. Did you find any of them involved?
The mining companies. There are a few things that points towards mining companies, and when it comes to Susan Williams' research, she is going into the old structures called the Monday Club. That was a very right-wing Tory organization or club for Tory MPs. And some of these MPs, Charles Waterstone, Patrick Wall, and Sir Lord Selborne, were very... they had very big interests in the mining companies in Southern Africa and also in real estate in Southern Africa. Charles Waterstone and Lord Selborne were on the boards of many of the big companies, Union Minière, Tank, Rhodesian Selection Trust.
Okay, so
the giants down there.
Okay, so we're hearing about France and Britain, really, but not the CIA, not the United States.
That is not the impression that Alexander Jones has. And the only connection we have is in the documents that were presented by Desmond Tutu in 1998. In one of the documents, it says that Alan Dulles is giving a green light for the operation to kill Dag Hammarskjöld. So that would be the only... connection, a close connection to Saimar that we can see. CIA, I think that if you have an organization, a clandestine military organization working from the base in a base in having a base in South Africa, that would be in the know of any of the big agencies, and then that they would have a blind eye to what they did, or they are informed but not objective.
Because there was one of the US officials actually at the time in 1961 who tried to report that he'd seen another aircraft, that possibly Dag Hammarskjöld's plane in 1961 had been shot down. How did he get on?
Are you talking about Charles Southall? In the man that we have in the film?
Yes.
Yeah. He has told a story for even since the end of the 60s. And he has consequently said that there are tapes with the American authorities about this, because he was listening in to a communication between a pilot and someone where he can hear the plane being shot down. And he says these tapes are with the NSA in the US. So those tapes have been, several people have tried to get to them, and the American authorities are just refusing to let them go. They are admitting that there are records of that kind in the archives, but that they are classified due to relation to foreign powers. So there is something there, but no one really knows what it is. And John Southall is actually not the only one. There was also another operator, the CIA operator named Paul Abram, that was listening to the almost exact same conversation, but from the tower side of this. So he listened, and he is also given testimony to the United Nations now that he has heard the same thing. So there is obviously, but that is all, it means that they know, these organizations, the NSA and the CIA, they know about what is happening when Dag Hammarskjöld is being shot down, but it doesn't mean that they are involved in the planning or the performance of the attack.
I mean, in some ways, it's a little bit like the assassination of John F. Kennedy. It sends a kind of chilling effect onto the institution if justice is not done. You know, if the perpetrators are not arrested, put on trial and jailed for something like this. So what do you think has been the long-term effect of allowing Dag Hammarskjöld's killers to get away with it?
Well, the most apparent effect is that the United Nations has lost almost all of its power, that we today do not have a multinational strong body to sort of host or bolster the conflicts that we have in the world. So that is the big and sad effect of the killing of Dag Hammarskjöld. And then, of course, now most people and even the United Nations' own investigators are saying that the most probable cause of the crash is that he was shot down, that he was subject to an attack. And I think that the signal is two ways. One is that we have all been kept in the dark for a very, very long time, and there are lots of people who have known about this and has been part of a big cover-up to and that you basically can get away with anything if you have the means.
You took this and won Best Documentary. Were you surprised?
The film had its premiere in Sundance. That is earlier in the year, and we needed to have the premiere earlier. So Sundance is a huge film festival in Utah in the U.S. Well, the experience was fantastic. We had the film was incredibly well received, and we had fantastic audiences and talks with people. So no, it was absolutely marvellous, fantastic.
I mean, if any listeners want to watch the film, how do they do that? Because although it was on the BBC late in the evening back in November 2019, you can no longer watch it on the iPlayer. So if people want to watch your film, how can they do that?
I'm not a part of the distribution. Sort of, we have a distributor who arranges all that. But in England, I'm not sure whether it will be on cinemas. And I know that the BBC have it. Possibly they will broadcast it again. I'm not really sure. Then if you're in the US, then it's available on all streaming platforms over there. So, well, that is what I know. And then it's still screening on cinemas in different places, in different countries.
Okay, so you can see some trailers for it and things like that on YouTube. Do you just remind us of the title of the film?
It's Cold Case Hammarskjöld.
Cold Case Hammarskjöld.
Cold Case Hammarskjöld, yeah.
Okay, and if people want to sort of get hold of or follow developments with your work and that sort of thing, is there any way they can do that? Maybe follow you on Twitter, social media, or website, a blog?
There is a Facebook group for Cold Case Hammarskjöld. It's possible to follow that. Then Mats Brügger is the director, and he's available on Facebook and Twitter as well. So anyone who wants to know more can contact him.
Okay, I hate to say it, but you're probably going to have to spell his name, because some of these Swedish names are a bit difficult to spell. As the journalist, investigative journalist who fronts the documentary, he's obviously quite an interesting chap and people may wish to follow him. So can you spell his name for us, please?
Yeah, well, he's actually even harder to, because he's Danish, harder to spell. Oh. But it's M-A-D-S and then B-R-U-G-G-E-R. And Google him and you will find ways to contact him.
Okay, Andreas, thanks very much for joining us.
Yes, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. You can contact us, suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, that is Ella Mapes, James Boddington, and also to Andreas Roxton, the producer of Cold Case Hammarskjöld. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazenko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. If you've got some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for other opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. So, thanks for listening to Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling. I'm off for a couple of months now, but the Friday Politics Show will be covered very nicely. That's what BCFM Politics Show on Friday, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Thousand and one nights.